Well, folks, we made it. We survived Black Friday, Small Business Saturday, and Cyber Monday, the biggest shopping days in the year, which have somehow slipped the bonds of their designated days and extend for weeks, just like everything seems to do now. Black Friday sales started in early November, right? Americans spent $11 billion on Black Friday and $44 billion over that five-day sales period. These shopping days are followed closely by Giving Tuesday, and I expect many of us had our email boxes flooded with appeals for donations. Started in 2021 and yielding $4 billion in donations this year, Giving Tuesday encourages year-end gifts and seeks to counter that spending spree of the previous weekend. In the wake of this commercial and philanthropic blitz that we have just come through, and as we approach the seasons of Hanukkah, Christmas, and Kwanzaa, which all involve the exchange of gifts, I thought it would be helpful to pause and consider why we give to others and how we can graciously give and receive, not just material gifts, but in the way we live. As our opening words suggested, giving can take many forms. It can be the fabubu we managed to score for our niece's Christmas present, giving a caregiver a break by staying with their loved one for an afternoon, spending time staffing the soup kitchen or the warming shelter, donating to organizations whose mission and values we share. There are innumerable ways that we can give to others. The reasons why we give can be as varied as how we give. The string of donor names that precedes many programs suggests that some people at least give for the recognition and/or the tax benefit they give from it. The Ken Burns documentary series on the American Revolution begins with a full 90 seconds, a minute and a half, and that was how long we did our silent reflection. That's how long it took to name all the individual foundation and corporate donors who gave enough to have their names mentioned before this flagship program. And while I'm sure they appreciate the recognition, I have to assume that most of them gave to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting because they value what that entity brings and they want to guarantee its survival in the wake of federal funding cuts. So our congregation does not publish a list of donors, so I am assuming that is not why most of us give to the church. But the words we read as we receive the offering each week remind us why we give. First, we give to remind ourselves how many gifts we have to offer. Most of us can give monetary gifts, but almost all of us can give our time, our attention, our talents. Sharon told me last week that on Christmas Day, she and Duncan will be visiting nursing homes. Now that he is a certified therapy dog, they will be spending that day giving their time and Duncan's tail wags and cuddles to anyone who has no place else to be on that day. We also give to remember that we are part of something bigger than ourselves. We are part of a vibrant local church community. We're part of an active Western PA network of UU churches and other UUs across the country and around the world, as well as others who promote free thinking and liberal religion. We are also part of a movement for positive social change that is more important now than ever, because our gifts can help counter the restrictions that are being imposed by the current administration. We also give because we believe in music and sacred space and children and all who enter this sanctuary. This church has a small part-time staff, but it includes two musicians, Sharon and Amy, because we recognize what an important part music plays in feeding our souls and in enlivening our worship. We're fortunate enough to have others who share their musical gifts, Paul, Sandy, the UU band, choir members. We're very blessed that all of these folks share their music, whether paid or not, in order to bring that into our worship service. Our financial gifts enable us to maintain sacred space where all are welcome, including the children in our preschool, people who come for AA meetings, soup on Saturday, and other programs we offer. Especially in these times, we provide a haven, a spiritual home for folks who may not feel welcome in other religious spaces. Finally, we give with the faith that together we have abundance. No one of us on our own could maintain our historic buildings and our programs and services and even our small part-time staff, but we can when each of us gives what we are able. We rattle off these words each week as we receive our offering, but it's good now and then to stop and reflect on these reminders of why we give. This affirmation also suggests how we can make giving a way of life. I first thought about preaching on this topic when I encountered the idea of Tonglen in a book by the Buddhist nun Pema Chodron. Tonglen is a Tibetan Buddhist practice, meditation practice, that involves breathing in suffering and breathing out peace and healing. The word Tonglen literally means giving and receiving, from Tong, which is giving or sending, and Len, which is receiving. The purpose of Tonglen is to reduce selfish attachment and cultivate compassion and loving kindness. In Tonglen, we breathe in what is painful. We don't resist or avoid our own pain or that of others. This reminds us of our connection, our kinship with all beings, and our connection to their suffering. And then we bring out feelings of peace, well-being, and goodwill, sending good energy to the world around us. Meditation, as it's practiced in secular Western culture, often encourages us to do the exact opposite, to breathe in good to make ourselves feel better, and then to breathe out the bad, ridding ourselves of any negative emotions. Now, I do want to say the ability and appropriateness of practicing Tonglen depends on the person and the situation. At times, it could be harmful for someone to breathe in pain and suffering. But the practice itself strikes me as a fundamentally different orientation to Western consumer culture that focuses us on ourselves, whereas Tonglen cultivates awareness of others and helps us to see ourselves not as beings in need, but as those who can give to others. This difference in orientation can make giving feel countercultural in our country. As I noted in my sermon on gratitude last month, advertisements that drive our consumer culture focus on our own desire in order to cultivate greed and dissatisfaction so we will continue to buy more things. Consumer culture has created a nation of takers, building on the pattern of our colonial ancestors and our roots in the Jewish Christian tradition. Preaching at Chautauqua last summer, Brian McLaren reflected on the biblical story of conflict between indigenous people and colonizers that goes back as far as the promised land that the Israelites claimed. Asserting that God had given them the land of Canaan despite the fact that other people inconveniently lived there, they understood their conquest of those people to be God's act. As we can read in the book of Deuteronomy, when the Lord your God brings you into the land where you are entering to possess it and clears away many nations before you, the Hittite and the Girgashites and the Amorites and the Canaanites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites, seven nations greater and stronger than you, and when the Lord your God delivers them into your hand and you defeat them, then you shall utterly destroy them. You shall make no covenant with them and show them no favor. Religious people have used such scripture passages ever since to claim their own conquests as acts of God. They didn't take the land. God gave it to them. In the treaty that ended the American Revolution, Britain ceded to the United States all the territory extending from the Appalachian Mountains to the Mississippi River, again, despite the fact that it was home to dozens of indigenous nations. And they had lived there for thousands of years. Those same colonizers took people from their homes in Africa and built a robust economy on their uncompensated labor. Our industrial economy relies on taking from the natural world. We refer to fossil fuels and raw materials for manufacturing goods as natural resources, emphasizing their benefit to us rather than seeing them as living beings to whom we are intimately connected. Nature is reduced to a storehouse of objects available for our taking, not a community of subjects that are sacred in their own right. Taking is written into our national DNA. It is foundational to the American narrative. Now, based on a conversation Harmony and I had a week or two ago, I want to emphasize that taking is not the same thing as receiving. Receiving is an act of generosity in itself, which is just as important as giving. In teaching children how to receive Hanukkah gifts, the educational website Jewish Interactive distinguishes between taking and receiving. They note that taking is an act of self-interest, whose goal is for that child getting what the child wants. A child can take from another person, but taking can also be a solitary act. They can take a cookie, a toy, or another object that belongs to someone else. By contrast, receiving is a social act. It recognizes the other and provides an opportunity to express gratitude, reinforcing the relationship between the giver and the receiver. The website encourages children to thank people for Hanukkah gifts, even the gifts that they don't like, teaching them the importance of graciously receiving another person's generosity, which is more important than the gift itself, or as many of us were taught, it's the thought that counts, right? I read recently about a woman named Kay who constantly gave to others as a teacher, a spiritual advisor, a community organizer. She gave to her family, her church, her community, anyone in need. In retirement, she volunteered with a refugee resettlement committee. But at age 84, Kay was diagnosed with cancer and given 3 to 6 months to live. Instead of isolating herself or lamenting that she could no longer give to others, Kay taught her community how to graciously receive. As her illness progressed, she allowed friends and colleagues to assist her and her family. She agreed to let the refugee resettlement committee she had worked with host a dinner in her honor and allow her to say goodbye. Of the more than 100 people who gathered that evening, several spoke about the impact Kay had made on their lives, and many others wrote cards that she could read later. When she died just 2 weeks later, Kay had modeled a life of gracious giving and receiving. Kay's story also illustrates that giving is a privilege. You can only give to others when you have enough. Enough resources, disposable time, physical and emotional well-being. But having enough is relative. We all have different levels for what we need and what we can spare. I always think about a seminary classmate of mine who shared that her congregation decided to take up a holiday offering to help one of its own families who lived very humbly. The congregation kept the name of that family anonymous, just out of privacy concerns. So the largest single gift to the collection was from the family it was intended for. They did not see themselves as being in need, but felt they had more than enough and could give to this other family they'd heard about. They lived out the saying, "Those who are content with little possess everything." The U.S. standard of living poses a high bar for what is enough, also a high bar for gift giving. Advertisements measure the value of a gift by the price tag. 'Tis the season of ads for luxury vehicles topped with big red bows that people find out in the driveway Christmas morning, diamond jewelry and $1,000 iPhones for stocking stuffers. But if most of us think about the best gift we have ever given or received, it's rarely a gift someone was persuaded to buy because of an advertisement. But instead, it's something that involved thoughtfulness, heart, and creativity. In cleaning out my parents' house, I found gifts they had obviously treasured. Homemade cards from the grandkids and as far back as when we were kids, with our own words of love instead of those written by Hallmark. Wonky little boxes made out of popsicle sticks. Coupons that I gave my dad when I was low on cash that were redeemable for baking batches of his favorite biscuits or having his back scratched. Our parents, in turn, gave us memorable experiences. For years, their Christmas gift to us was to rent a house at the Outer Banks the next summer for a week that was large enough for all of us to be together. After my dad died, Mom started writing stories about her past, and on Christmas morning, whenever Mom passed out that year's story, the gift opening stopped, and we all pored over the account that she had just handed us, about her having a case of the measles on the weekend she was the May Queen at her college. Or the tale of a fourth grade heartthrob about the crush she'd had on our dad since grade school. Or the family trip where her brother's 1929 Ford had 7 flat tires in one day and he had to fix the fuel line with chewing gum. All of these were written in Mom's distinctive Appalachian storytelling style, and the dozen or so stories that she wrote in her last years are among my most treasured possessions, as well as the memories that we made when the family was all together. Giving should be prompted by sincere generosity. It should be a gift of the heart. It should not be prompted by obligation or the expectations posed by holidays, nor feeling like you need to reciprocate if someone unexpectedly gives you a gift. A gift like that requires only our equally sincere gratitude. Giving should not strain relationships, but should deepen and strengthen our ties to each other. May you be blessed in this coming season by gifts that surprise and delight you, and the opportunity to delight others with your gifts, whether they are large or small, material gifts, or sharing of your time, your talents, and your own spirit. May it be so.